meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Tonight, Wendy Murphy's here. She's a former district attorney, law professor, and author of the book, And Justice for Some, an expose of the lawyers and judges who let dangerous criminals go free. Wendy and I are going to talk about this police officer, or former police officer, Bobby Cutts, who was recently found guilty of murdering his former girlfriend and their unborn child. Wendy, hi, how are you?
Hi, Dana. It's good to be with you.
Nice.
How are you doing?
Nice to have you on. I'm doing fine. As usual, you've been taking names and kicking butt on all the TV cable shows and stuff like that. That's good. that's what makes you such That's what makes you such a popular guest here on my program. But just before we get to Bobby Cutts, I want to ask you, and I know you and I have talked about this story before, and we're going to cover it a little bit later on with Mark Garagos, the Vandersloot case in Aruba and the decision of the appellate court not to rearrest Joran after the sting operation and confessions that he made to this undercover reporter. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, boy, very frustrating. You know, on the one hand, I wasn't surprised because
I had
a bad taste in my mouth for a long time watching that case unfold unfairly. And, you know, how many times can you watch as they rearrest and uncover new evidence and then watch as the suspects get released time and time again. So I was pretty cynical.
Yep.
But I guess I wasn't shocked. On the other hand, you know, if you can't proceed with a case where it's pretty darn clear this character, Vandersloot, was the primary responsible party, and now you have a confession and a boatload, so to speak, of circumstantial evidence, if you can't proceed with a case like that, what the heck kind of legal system are they running over there? That's how I reacted. And on the other hand, you know, my cynical side says, look, the guy's from a very influential family.
Yeah.
You know, that almost always is the beginning and the end of the story when the victim is a foreigner who nobody cares about and has no political sway. That's why I think the most important thing we've been able to do in this country and in Canada, I mean, for people who really do care about the power of politics in terms of making justice work fairly for victims, we have to speak with our pocketbooks, and that means not going over there and making it clear that if they depend on our money to sustain their economy and they're not going to treat violence against our citizens fairly, then we're not going to continue to spend our money there. It's not going to get justice for Natalie, but it will potentially help the next victim and the next case be treated more responsibly.
Yeah, absolutely. And when my audience, when we were promoting the show tonight, saw the title of your book, Judges Who Let Dangerous Criminals Go Free, as part of it, of course, they jumped on that right away and said, ask her about Natalie Holloway. You know, just before we go on, when you look at the evidence, you look at the confessions, several of them, on this videotape, a buddy of mine, Art Wood, who's a former Secret Service agent and who has investigated this case, will be on cable TV tonight talking about how the dad, we talked about the influential family, his computer, when it was analyzed that night, the night that Natalie disappeared, some of the responses that came back from the computer, some of the reports came back saying that he was surfing sites about the effects of drugs and alcohol on the body. You and I have talked about this. I uncovered it on my show several months before it was put on cable TV, where the family were asked about Natalie Holloway and whether or not she suffered from epilepsy.
Right.
And then when this kid, this loser, confesses on video, he talks about her having seizures. So not only the evidence is there, but there's also a stinking smell of corruption.
Yeah, and you did such a good job, Dana. I mean, you cover the cases with the depth that people want, and you know, I'm so grateful for the fact that you do it, and you do it so well. especially giving a lot more voice to the victim side of things than a lot of the cable shows. So that said, what you did in terms of uncovering that Natalie's family was asked virtually from day one about whether Natalie had a seizure disorder or epilepsy leads you to believe that, of course, they believe she died in some fashion associated with a seizure. How do they get that information? Where did they get that information? Okay, so perhaps they had a suspicion from whatever websites the dad was searching. But it's also very possible they had knowledge. They had inside direct knowledge that somebody told them, and I'm talking about the cops literally knowing that this was a quote-unquote accidental death. The kid freaked out, got scared, dumped the body. You know, on the one hand, it's good to corroborate what you believe was true from the beginning, which is to say he's responsible for it. It wasn't an intentional death. I still hold him fully responsible.
Yep.
But you've got to be kidding me that they can't find some crime to charge. Here's a kid who, even if you think you can't prove murder because it was an accidental death and he freaked out and did all the wrong things, not only is he so arrogant about it, you don't want to send the message that this is the kind of behavior you want to indulge. I don't care if you're a Reuben, Dutch, or anything else, or a Martian. You don't want to send a message that you want to tolerate this kind of arrogance in the aftermath of such a serious crime and a loss of life, a criminal loss of life. But why not charge him with something? You know, Al Capone, you could only get him on tax evasion.
Exactly.
But it mattered. Everybody was cheering. At least we got him on tax evasion. So we can't prove all the other horrible crimes, but we got him on something.
Yep.
There's no question in my mind that a legitimate legal system would take any steps they could, even if they're baby steps, to prosecute this guy for something. Covering up the body, you know, obstruction of justice, lying to authorities, I don't care. Something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I told Beth Holloway that justice comes in several forms, but what we all hope for is she's able to bring her daughter home. But besides that, let's get into this Bobby Cutts. I'm looking at a picture of him right now on the internet with the tissues, and he's crying, and but that didn't help. He ended up getting sentenced, or not sentenced yet, but convicted of murdering his former girlfriend and unborn child. And I know you've been on the shows, the cable shows, talking about this case in particular while it was going on. I want to ask you, as a former DA, of course, law professor, here we have an ex-police officer who showed a lot of different things when he was up on that stand. And one particular question that I, you know, perked up on when I heard him ask, why didn't you call 911? And his response was, I am 911. There's always that arrogance that's back there, and that just drove me crazy. Your thoughts on Bobby Cutts?
Yeah, you know, the guy was nothing if not an actor wannabe, but a bad one. And when he said, I am 911, and you know that he was spending lots of his brain power trying to come up with good explanations for all the evidence, which he didn't do at all,
no.
In my opinion, not even one piece of evidence. But when he said, I am 911, what struck me about that was that this is the kind of person we all thought he was. Arrogant, entitled, chock full of power. He's got a gun. He's a cop. He feels untouchable. He's got women all over the place birthing, I don't know how many of his kids.
Yeah.
He's hardly responsible for any of them. And he feels entitled to do whatever he wants, because he knows that if these women who he's beating and abusing or whatever make a call to the cops, he's going to be able to put the kibosh on that. That's an incredible amount of power to exploit and to take advantage of. And that is the kind of guy who, if it gets bad enough for him, he's going to take it to the ultimate level. Because just like, you know, the Stacey Peterson case, there's a cop who already, what everybody believes, got away with murdering one woman. Why not think you can get away with it again? That's the kind of attitude I could tell coming out of Bobby Cutts. And by the way, Dana, I know that you said he was crying. I wouldn't call it crying. I think that's an overstatement, because what he was doing, I think, was acting, faking it. And there were no tears, as the prosecutor said in his first question on cross. Are you, do you have a cold, Mr. Cutts? Because I don't see any tears.
Yeah.
And I actually thought there were so many things about the case that were over the top in terms of his presentation. That's why I was shocked he took the stand. It almost felt like they were setting the case up for reversal on appeal, ineffective assistance of counsel. What kind of lawyer in his right mind would put a guy like that on the stand to lie through his teeth? The jury can respect the right to remain silent. The Fifth Amendment lets everybody say nothing. It's a right to shut up. It's not a right to lie. It's not a right to fake cry under oath.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you feel the tension in the courtroom around the effort to manipulate, you know that what the jury's thinking to itself is, I hate this guy even more. It's bad enough that there's a boatload of evidence against him. Now he's lying to me. He's fake crying, trying to win me, trying to manipulate me into feeling bad for him. Now I hate him even more. That's why I think there's no question they're going to vote for death. There is a silver lining in the case, though, Dana, and I want to emphasize this as an activist for children's rights in particular. Remember, the 2.5-year-old child, his own son, was apparently an eyewitness, and he made statements that everybody said would never be admitted into evidence because he's only two. He said, "Mommy's in the rug, Daddy's angry, Mommy broke the table." As it turns out, Bobby Cutts himself corroborates the kid. Bobby Cutts basically said he wrapped the woman in a blanket and a comforter, that the table did break. Obviously, he was angry. What I like about the whole story is that the child's statements came in. We all heard them, and now we're going to think better about kids as witnesses, children's credibility, because we're all going to remember this. When someone says, "Oh, a 3, 4, 5, or 6-year-old, you can't believe them; they're too young." Ah, mm-hmm. But remember Bobby Cutts' son, Mommy's in the rug. As young as 2.5 years old, they can provide important, compelling, reliable evidence in a court of law. And here's an interesting question. Here's an interesting issue as a matter of law. I teased my students about it last week, to get them to think about it, because they haven't really encountered this kind of issue. I said the child is clearly not competent to testify as a witness because he can't take the oath and swear to tell the truth. He's not sophisticated enough to understand these concepts. But his statements, nevertheless, were considered reliable enough to be admitted. So you can be an incompetent witness, but make statements that the legal system is willing to respect. And I think I think that kind of evidence can often be the thing that makes or breaks a case. I don't think it was essential here because there was so much evidence against Bobby Cutts. And by the way, let me just tell your listeners one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
I read through a lot of the testimony in the trial, and this was a guy with four kids from I don't know how many women. As you know, another of his babies was on the way, about to be born, a little girl.
Yeah.
Who he killed. He also had a wife at the time of the trial. We know he had his girlfriend, who he killed. And two other women testified. Both said they were his girlfriends at the time of the murder. Okay? One of them said not only was she his girlfriend, she was pregnant with his child.
Jeez.
And she had an abortion of his child on the day Stacy... on the day his girlfriend was reported missing. This new girlfriend had an abortion of his child on the day the poor young woman, pregnant, 9 months pregnant, was reported missing. This is the kind of guy he was. And he had the audacity to blame his 2-year-old son for spilling bleach at the crime scene.
Jeez.
All over the spot where the victim's body was laying. He said his son spilled the bleach because he was a, messy 2-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be that bleach also destroyed trace evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, had the gall to suggest that people would believe he didn't intend to kill his unborn child. When asked the question, "What did you do? What did you do to try to save your unborn baby daughter? Your almost born baby daughter?" The answer was, "He did nothing."
Right. He came up with some dopey stories about putting a little bit of Javix in a cap and trying to revive her with that. And it was, and I agree with you, it was a pathetic testimony at best. It's Jessie Marie Davis.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Oh,
and there,
I'm so sorry. I was mixing her up.
That's okay.
We're talking about two cases at the same time.
Well, there's so many. That's just it. There's so many cases out
similar.
There.
They're similar.
Yeah, and it just has to be something. And it brings me to my next question. Because there's been, and of course, because law enforcement or former law enforcement are involved, there's more of a focus on these cases and they become more high profile. But we've talked, you and I have talked about teachers, and there's more cases about teachers abusing children now. But we're hearing more cases of these cops, these rogue cops with four or five wives, three or four girlfriends, pregnant abortions, all this sort of stuff, killing, disappearance, all this sort of stuff. What's wrong with today and police officers? Is there a problem with the screening process that we have? Is it an issue of the power trip because you get that badge and that gun? What is it, Wendy? Because we're seeing a lot more of it, sadly.
Yeah, I think that we are, Dana. I mean, some people will say it's not that we're seeing more of it, we're just talking more about it. And frankly, I think it's probably a little bit of both. An uptick in incidents and we're talking more about it, which, by the way, is a good thing.
Right.
I think the answer is more complicated, and I'm certainly not an expert, but let me toss out a few factors. It is absolutely a recipe for disaster when you give someone an incredible amount of power, expect them to really, you know, quite legitimately treat the bad guys out there with roughness and hostility and to manipulate and control them. I mean, that's what cops are trained to do, right? To go out into the real world, confront the bad guys, deal with them harshly, and then we ask them to just turn the switch off when they go home. That's not an easy thing to do. It's not impossible, but it's not an easy thing to do. So what you have to be careful with is when you're screening cops, when you're thinking about who to hire and who to give that kind of power to, what you really need to look for is not so much, you know, do they have a criminal record and are they rocket scientists, but do they have the character? Do they have the good moral sense of what the job requires? Can they carry the badge and understand that power should not be abused? It should be respected. And you know, that's a hard thing to screen for. I say the same kind of thing about teachers. We're about to give you an incredible amount of authority over very vulnerable kids. We have to know whether you're going to take advantage of these kids, especially when it comes to the female teachers taking advantage of the prepubescent boys. You know, what a recipe for disaster, given that what the boys are thinking about and they're becoming sexual, and the teachers, if they're immature, don't know how to deal with that. It is about maturity. It's about screening for good character. It's about making sure that you're putting people in positions of power who, first and foremost, understand the importance of not taking advantage of that power. Bobby Cutts obviously had been a cop for a very long time, probably before they did any kind of screening. I think things have changed. Most cops are good people. Most cops are absolutely aware that they shouldn't take advantage of their power. And a lot of the cops that I've worked with, not only are they aware that they shouldn't take advantage of their power, they tend to be, if anything, incredibly empathic and really good citizens. You know, they know that they can't lock everybody up. They're not cowboys looking to, you know, get notches on the belt. They are there to be, you know, guides, if you will. And really importantly, they are also there to be leaders. And in terms of their community, young people in particular look up to them. They have a great deal of influence. And, you know, I think they understand it for the most part. You get a couple of rogue cops out there who it goes to their head. They get to, you know, they get all kinds of benefits by taking advantage of their power, and then they just keep going. It's almost like an addiction. And how do you get rid of them? They got unions.
Yeah.
You know, unless they burn down, you know, City Hall, they get to keep their jobs.
Right.
I think unions are a big part of the problem. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have unions advocating that zealously for somebody like Bobby Cutts to keep his job. And he had a history of problems, as did Peterson. You know, these are guys who should have been cut loose a long time ago. I'm not sure that it's only the fault of unions that they got to stay, but look what happened as a result. Three women are dead.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you know, were killed by these guys, in my opinion. I think that's too great a price to pay, and, you know, frankly, if we're not screening them well enough as they're walking into the job, maybe we just need to do a little tweaking of the rules so that we can get rid of them a little bit better, faster, as soon as they start to act up.
That's a huge responsibility. Wendy, we're down to about 2 minutes here. Now with, again, your book, and Justice for Some, I'm sure that, you know, you could write another chapter tomorrow on another case or another instance or another judge. Yeah, with the exposure, especially that you've brought forward with your book, O'Reilly and others have brought forward with these judges, are you seeing it getting somewhat better, or do we still have the cases where, you know, judges are just out to lunch, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, you know, I think, strangely enough, I do think it's likely to get better, and I'll give you a little inside ball on this. But let me also say that I actually am on O'Reilly tonight. Not so much talking about bad judges, but a slightly different issue. Your listeners might find it funny, in fact. But that's an aside. I think one of the funny things about, and as you know, Bill O'Reilly wrote the foreword for my book, and it's a terrific foreword. I'm very flattered that he wrote what he wrote. He knows that it's really hard to take on judges because you get in trouble. You get blacklisted. I'm absolutely blacklisted by a lot of judges. Not all. Some of them have thick enough skin. They take the criticism well, and they're open to it as well. They should be. They're the government, after all. We should all be comfortable speaking out against the government, whichever branch it is, legislative, executive, and judicial. Sometimes they forget that they are the government and that the people have the right to speak out against them when they're not doing their job right. That said, judges really don't feel good about the book that I wrote, and that's okay. I knew that going into it. But here's the benefit. I know from my judge friends on the inside who still talk to me, mind you, secretly sometimes, they say, look it, we go to meetings, we go to conferences, we have dinner together, and we all say to each other, damn, I don't want to show up on O'Reilly's show tomorrow night. I mean, you know, they're not saying I don't want Murphy to write a chapter about me. I'm not hardly influential enough. But the bottom line is they do care what the public thinks of them and their work. That's not a bad thing. There is very little accountability for judges. The one source of accountability we have is the media. Somebody like Bill O'Reilly, who's done a terrific job, provides some oversight. The fact that they sit together and say, I'm worried about showing up on O'Reilly, is a good thing. It's not a perfect remedy. It's not going to stop the rogue judges from slipping around the corners and doing things even more covertly than before. But the fact that they're talking about it and worried about it, you know, it's a new phenomenon. It wasn't happening 20 years ago when I was a new prosecutor. And, you know, it can only help to shine an antiseptic light on any branch of government, no matter what they're doing.
Well, absolutely. Keep them honest, Wendy. You're always welcome here on the program.
Thanks a lot, Dana. Take care.
Okay, talk soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Wendy Murphy, and we'll be back in just a minute with current Deputy District Attorney Robin Sachs and high-profile high-profile attorney Mark Garagos. If there's someone that knows about high-profile cases, it's Mark. We'll be right back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. If you've been following the cable news shows, in particular Fox News, you'll have seen my next two guests many times, CNN, MSNBC, you name it, all the big shows. Robin Sachs is a current deputy district attorney with L.A. County. And, of course, Mark Garagos is a defense attorney in Los Angeles area. Mark is no stranger to high-profile cases. Most recently, we saw Robin on the lineup on Fox, and I thought she did a great job there.
Okay, I'm back.
I figured we'd bring them here, and Mark is back with us right now to talk about Joran van der Sloot. And I always get in trouble when I say Sloot, but that's okay. They can send me some nasty emails. Actually, Sloat, but we won't get into that debate. Mark Garagos is no stranger to high-profile cases. All you have to do is turn on the television, read the newspaper, and you'll see that he's been there, done that. And, of course, Robin has also been doing a lot of TV analyst work lately. And I'm going to start with Mark. First of all, welcome you to the program, sir. And
thank you.
Ask you obviously it's hard for you to take off your defense attorney hat, but I'm going to ask you to leave it on here for just a minute. And imagine, if you will, that you're representing a client like Joran van der Sloot, a high-profile case. I know that probably gives you night sweats because you've done this many times. And all of a sudden, there on television is a hidden camera interview of your client where he is, in my opinion, confessing his heart out. Now, after you are revived by the paramedics, how do you feel about that?
Well, there's never a... anytime you've got a client who's on tape, it gives you the willies to begin with. And whether it's a hidden camera or not hidden camera, it's generally a really bad idea. I've had clients who've done interviews before they've retained me, and it's been one of the worst experiences I've had. Although I've had, and I think Robin could probably tell you as well, there have been some times where it's actually helped out a client. This is certainly not a situation that helps out the client. The lawyer, I'm sure, is mortified. And I think what they came out and just said is he was role-playing or this or that. I don't know how most people are going to take that. I would think with a great deal of skepticism. And one of the attacks is going to be is that you're not going to be allowed to bring it in and try to prevent that from coming into evidence.
Now, we don't know if this is going to go to trial yet or not, Mark, but...
they haven't even, at this point, as far as I know, haven't even filed anything.
If it did go to trial, and obviously Prosecutor 101, and we'll get to Robin about this in a minute or two, you would want to have some corroborating evidence as far as what is said on tape. But when you come to a confession, you don't have to say, I killed her and here's how I did it. His statements, and I'm paraphrasing here somewhat, were, I'll be in big trouble if they find her. How do you defend against something like that?
Well, actually, in California, I couldn't tell you in Aruba. I certainly do not profess to have any expertise on Aruban law. But if you were in California, absent corroboration, there's what's called the no corpus, no cop-out rule.
Right.
You don't get that in unless you've got a corpus. Now, recently, the case law has been that the evidence of a corroboration, if you will, it just has to be slight, and the Supreme Court has said it's just barely, so to speak. But that's one of the attacks. And then if there's some explanation for why the person says what they're saying, then you you go with that as well. And you basically have to understand what the context was and whether or not the tape is accurate and whether or not you've got everything, whether it's been doctored. I mean, there certainly has been numerous cases where tapes and so-called confessions have been altered. And then there's quite a bit, you know, even in the DNA cases where they've proven people innocent who've been convicted, in a lot of those cases there were false confessions where guys had actually confessed. And in fact, they were not true. And the DNA later exculpated them. So I always take those things with a grain of salt unless you know the complete circumstances of them.
Robin Sachs, Deputy District Attorney in Los Angeles County. Now, I want you to counter everything that Mark has said, but we have to look at some of the evidence that's there, and some of it may be circumstantial. Something that came up on my program long ago, in December, in fact, interviewing Natalie Holloway's stepfather, I asked him a question like, what was one of the strangest, you know, things that happened to you when you first got to the island, and some of the questions you were asked. And he said, you know, Dana, one of the things that they asked me was, did Natalie suffer from any sort of medical condition where she'd have seizures or epilepsy? And we talked about that a little bit. And then lo and behold, with this confession tape, he talks about how the girl was seizuring or having whatever. So the question comes up then, how did the police find out? Are we having a problem with corruption here? Is there is this corroborating evidence? Art Wood, Secret Service agent, current investigator, says that when the dad, Paulus Vandersloot's computer was analyzed, the results came back that night, the night that the Natalie went missing, the dad was surfing websites that dealt with the effects of drugs and alcohol on a body. How do you use that as a prosecutor?
Well, first of all, I think that good prosecutors put on their defense attorney hats pretty quickly and evaluate the case from the worst possible light in order to be able to be prepared and defend against the arguments that someone like Mark will make in court. And I think that when you look at this, the tape by itself, in and of itself, there are issues as to would that be able to stand alone? There are certainly statements that are incriminating, but I think it's important from a legal perspective to realize that this is not a confession. The tape is not a confession. A confession requires that the person admits to the elements of the crime. There's still a question as to what crime exactly was committed. Was there a rape? Was there a body dumping while Natalie was still alive? Or was there a murder case? So I think that we, from a critical point of view as a DA, I would have to analyze those. However, that tape is beautiful. There's nothing better than having someone put some personality to show exactly what kind of scumbag this guy is. And he really, his character speaks for himself. He talks about dumping Natalie, refers to her as a bitch, and he he's absolutely heartless in his discussion. He has not an ounce of compassion or care. And you can get a look into his character that he paints his own worst picture of himself. So you, if, instead of looking at it as the end-all, mean-all, it's a clue, it's a piece of the puzzle, and then you need to start taking the other things to corroborate it.
You know, we have to clarify here, that's alleged scumbag.
Right. Well, but in sex crimes, what I try to educate my juries on is that, particularly in sex cases, very rarely someone rapes somebody else with a witness or a live camera. And so it is a matter of finding pieces of the puzzle and putting it together. And in California, as Mark had pointed out, there is something that requires that more than a confession is required. There needs to be some sort of corroboration, even if it's scant corroboration.
Yeah, you know.
So the looking on the computer on Daddy, a.k.a. Dowry, computer is... with, you know, talking about what would happen when a body is dumped, that would be corroboration. Any sort of boat records would be corroboration. And then, of course, what was said by those the two brothers, what they both said and didn't say could be corroboration.
You know, Mark, when and it's coming out in the media a little bit now, but you look at the operative or the associate, whatever, that the crime reporter used to tape and talk to Vandersloot, how important, if this did go to trial, is it to go after that person's credibility?
Whose credibility?
The credibility of the guy that was asking Jorn Vandersloot the questions.
The person who's doing the surreptitious taping?
Absolutely.
I think, depending on what the circumstances are of the taping, if you've got somebody who sets out, I don't have any intimate knowledge of this, I'm just speculating, which I usually get mad at other people for doing, but if what is reported, let me just give you a hypothetical, if you've got somebody who sets out to try and get a confession by covert means, by ingratiating themselves and whatever along those lines, I think that person is fair game, because I think that's fairly despicable behavior. This person is presumably not law enforcement.
Right.
It's a completely different situation if it's law enforcement, although law enforcement, and there's a good reason, cannot pretend, well, they can certainly pretend to be a friend or this or that, but they could not ply somebody with either drugs or alcohol to get them to make a confession or an admission, and there's a difference between the two. And so if this is just some civilian wannabe who's looking for his 15 minutes of fame, and try to be a hero, I think that that's a person who's going to be fair game. And certainly, if not at trial, before trial, at some kind of a motion to exclude the tape in the first place as being the product of some kind of unconstitutional effort. You might remember that, I think within the last couple of years, there was a judge down in Orange County who was charged and prosecuted in a possession of pornography case,
right.
And the person who had kind of engineered that prosecution was some civilian hacker type who would go in and follow these things, and there one of the key pieces of litigation was whether or not that person was actually an agent of law enforcement. So you have pretrial motions that can ferret all those things out and determine whether in fact this is a person was just a wannabe or is acting at the behest of law enforcement and what their motivations are, because that, to some degree, that's going to always cast some doubt on or some hesitation upon somebody's motivations and the validity of the tape.
If you're just joining us, Robin Sachs and Mark Garagos are here.
Assuming there is. It's a very good point.
Yeah. And there, what I the point I'm going to come with Robin now is when you look at a Reuben law enforcement And you compare that to the Keystone Cops. The Keystone Cops have heads and tails ability over a Reuben law enforcement, in my opinion. You have now a tape, a confession, whatever you, sting operation, whatever you want to call it, that is not what we call a jailhouse confession. Apparently has nothing to do with law enforcement. It's done by a reputable crime reporter, 30 years in the business, who took it upon himself to, yes, he wants to get ratings, Robin, and get a story, but he wanted to bring closure to the case. But I think Mark makes a real good point here, is there's a lot more to it, and I, for one, wasn't surprised when Joran van der Sloot was not arrested. I'm hoping that they have more evidence and will eventually do this. But how do you go after that claim by the defense, like Mark brought up, as far as the credibility of the tape itself?
I think that a good trial attorney, whether it's a prosecutor or a defense attorney or any litigator for that matter, will acknowledge their weaknesses from the front and from the get-go. So from the very moment that you're picking a jury now in Aruba, again, it's not a jury system, so it wouldn't work quite as well in Aruba, although many things that you consider basic don't work really well in Aruba. But assuming that there was a jury system where you're having members of the community making a determination in someone's guilt, you own the weaknesses, and you say, you know what, you may not like the fact that this came from this in this way, but this is the way we got it. And frankly, thank goodness, because we got more answers from the, you know, regular media than we did from any law enforcement investigation that's been going on for the last 2 years.
Mark, I asked Joel Brodsky, who was on the program a couple of weeks ago, and he's representing Drew Peterson. And I don't want you to comment about that case specifically, but when you see a case like this, van der Sloot, Peterson, whatever, Mr. X, that is being not only investigated by enforcement, but law enforcement, but it's also being investigated in the media, where we have crime reporters, the Dana Pretzers, the Greta Van Susterns, whoever, going from door to door, also doing their own investigation. Joel Brodsky said to me very clearly he's going to, if charges are ever filed against his client, he's going to bring that up big time as far as how to defend his client because of what was done in the media. Is he just blowing smoke, or do you see a concern because the public has such a craving for these stories that the media is going too far to bring them to us?
Well, I have this whole theory. You don't have enough time to hear the whole thing, but there are certain kinds of cases, and they're not that often, or probably not that big of a percentage of the total criminal law practice, but what I call supersized cases.
Right.
And these cases, and what's happened is, I've seen at least over the last, I'd say, 12 years that I've been involved in handling maybe high-profile cases, that you've had this kind of what I call the English model, where you have the tabloids, and the tabloids have come over here with the advent of Fox News and with the cable channels and the cable wars between MSNBC and CNN and Fox. They get to then report things from the National Enquirer, and they can source it by saying, well, the National Enquirer reported, and then it's on Fox, and then CNN will pick it up, and in the old days, Court TV and MSNBC. And then the next thing you know, it jumps over to the morning shows. And then that becomes kind of the axis of evil, if you will, for the defendant, for the criminal defendant. And I don't have a problem with that, but, you know, in England, they have a contempt of court act. And when these cases get to the point where they are just almost at saturation level, the court has some real strength and a bite behind it in terms of clamping down on any interest and delaying coverage until after the case, after an arrest or after a trial. And in certain cases, I think that may be what we need to do here. Otherwise, it just becomes sport. I mean, I remember in Peterson's case, and I was complaining, we first had a change of venue from Stanislaus County out to San Mateo, and then we got to San Mateo, and we went through 1,600 jurors there, and I said, you know, Judge, it's not any better here. In fact, we've moved closer to the media center that was reporting on everything, and Judge DeLucchi, bless his heart, said something to the effect of, you know, we could shoot this case into and the jury into a space capsule and have him revolve around the Earth, and he still wouldn't get a fair trial. We're just going to make do with what we have. And that, I think, is a sad commentary.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And one of the cable hosts said that as much as she thinks that her show is seen by everyone, she finds it hard to believe that the jury pool would be poisoned by it. But, you know, it's not just the show, Robin Sachs. We have the Internet. We have programs like mine, YouTube, you name it, where these sorts of stories all of a sudden have a worldwide audience. And as a prosecutor, what do you do when you see a story like this that's not only being investigated by law enforcement who have brought their case to you as a prosecutor, but it's also being investigated by a crime reporter or a whatever on TV or the Internet or wherever you find them?
From a prosecutor point of view, it's never a good thing to have the media doing your investigation. All that says is that your cops think and your case sucks, frankly. If they're doing it for you, then there's already problems to begin with. The idea is if they're reporting on your case after it's been filed, while I personally don't enjoy my cases being in the media, I love talking about other people's, but not my own.
Right.
But I think that it doesn't help in terms of how you actually can get to the bottom of line of justice for anybody. We saw it in the Spectre case where statements were made and both the prosecution and the defense were deciding whether or not to put statements that were in the media in front of the jury or not. So it slices both ways. I do think that it's important for the population in the world to know what's going on in the criminal justice system. I think there's a lot of interest because it's real and it's the real stuff that happens every day. And to the extent that we can better protect ourselves and protect our children, the media is a wonderful way for us to learn how to do that. When the media becomes our lead investigators on a case, we've got bigger problems than we know.
If you're just tuning in, Mark Garagos is here and Robin Sachs, and we're talking about the Holloway case and some other high-profile cases in general. They're here for about another 5 minutes or so. Mark, obviously, again, no stranger to these types of high-profile cases. I want to get your thoughts on cameras in the courtroom because not only do we see what's going on and the people have a craving for that, but we also see, some would say, weaknesses in the system. I think Chris Darden was on a couple of weeks ago, and I'm sure he could comment about cameras and OJ. And again, people have this comment about what they say is Hollywood justice when we've covered Spectre and OJ. But what are your thoughts on cameras in the courtroom?
Well, I'll tell you, for a long time was against it, and once I hate to always reference Peterson, but that's a good example of a case that changed my mind on it. And the reason was is I thought that if we didn't have cameras in the courtroom in that case, that it would damp down the public interest in it, and I could try to get people to focus, and the people I'm talking about is the 12 jurors, on the evidence in that case. I think it had the opposite effect in retrospect. And I've done a couple of panels with Tom Mesereau, who succeeded me on Jackson's case, mm-hmm. Michael Jackson's case. And even though it was the opposite result in an acquittal there, Tom, who was also against cameras in the courtroom, came to the conclusion, and at least publicly on the panel we did at Loyola Law School, said that he too thinks it would have been a better idea in a case like that to have had cameras in the courtroom, because it would have been helpful for the public to have seen why it was the jury found him not guilty, which I think is a great take on it. I think, you know, there were people who disagree with the Spectre verdict, but I think Judge Fidler did an unbelievable job in conducting that case, and people who watched it, I think, would have come to the conclusion that a hung jury was an appropriate result in that case, Robin's office notwithstanding. I think the first vote by the jurors was split somewhere down the lines of 4-5-3, if you will, 4 for guilt, 5 for not guilty, and 3 abstaining. But that was a case that was that is tough by its nature and made tougher by some tactical decisions that were made on both sides. And I think that Fidler showed that you can handle a case like that does not get out of control, and that the public can use it as kind of a learning experience. And that, I wouldn't classify that as a supersized case. Spectris does not have the, by any means, the interest of a that a Peterson or a Jackson or a Kobe did,
right.
Kind of the next level, a second tier case. And in cases like that, I don't think that there's anything wrong with it.
Robin, I'm going to take you back to Aruba. I don't mean literally, because I won't step foot on the sand there, and that and your husband would be angry with me. But let's go back to Aruba, and let's look at the coverage that's there. I've talked to newspaper reporters, radio people, whoever from Aruba, and we look at not only the disappearance of the young girl and how tragic that is, but there's a two-pronged approach here that you have to look at Natalie and bringing someone to justice for why she's no longer on this earth, but we also have to look at the investigation itself and how far does this go? Is this corruption to the highest level? And you have to look at that too. So if a case like this, and again from the perspective of the prosecutor, where in some cases you cannot win no matter what you say unless the person that you're trying to try goes to jail for a very long time, it has to be difficult. And how do you, from the prosecution's perspective, deal with something like that when you know that you're going to be scrutinized no matter what you do?
There's a few things. First of all, if you always make honorable, ethical decisions and always do the best job you can, then whatever criticism you're going to get, so be it. So I think in a case, and I think this is the problem that we all have with Aruba, is that they haven't done their job in Aruba. They didn't at the beginning, and they didn't now, and they haven't. And that's the frustration, where here you have this place that is fueled by tourism, largely American dollars in tourism, and they did a shoddy job at an investigation, yep, when there was a young kid who was on their college trip there. So I think that you can't stand behind that and feel like you're part of an organization that's doing the right thing or doing the good thing when you know that that's just not the case.
Yeah, well said.
So the only thing I think that you could do at this point is just boycott Aruba. Go to Hawaii, go to somewhere else.
It's too far away from the West Coast anyway.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That sounds good.
Exactly.
Listen, I want to thank you guys for spending some time with us this evening. Mark Garagos, Robin Sachs, you're always welcome on the program.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Mark. Nice seeing you.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, we're going to be back in just a minute, where we're going to talk about this tragic shooting on Valentine's Day at Northern Illinois University, and we have a psychologist, Dr. Bev Smallwood, who's going to come on and talk about the mental aspect of why these things seem to be happening. It's a huge problem, it's a tragic problem, and it's something that we're going to deal with here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
If you've been following this tragic story out of Northern Illinois University, where a gunman killed 5 students and wounded 16 others last Thursday afternoon in DeKalb, he then killed himself. My next guest makes a statement. More and more young people are dealing with the inevitable frustration of pubescence and adolescence by fantasizing about blowing people away. There's more to it than that, but I thought I would bring on Dr. Bev Smallwood. She is a psychologist, author, and lecturer, and she's the author of her most recent book is This Wasn't Supposed to Happen to Me, 10 Make or Break Choices When Life Steals Your Dreams and Rocks Your World. Dr. Smallwood, welcome to the program.
And thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I never remembered these types of shootings and tragedy every time we turn on the news. There were recently a mall shooting, several university shootings, not necessarily just in the United States, Canada, across the world. We're hearing more and more and seeing more tragedy with these young people who decide to use your term, blow people away, and then, you know, take their own lives. Some will say, well, good, and some will say they're taking the coward's way out, but this is just, it's almost to an epidemic. Your thoughts?
Well, it certainly is happening more and more, and It's tragic, of course, every single time it happens. And I do think that there are some things that are happening in our culture and just in our families today that may be adding to this, as well as just the whole media attention.
Yeah.
Because if I'm a young person out there and I'm very frustrated and I'm feeling like I'm the world's treating me unfairly, and the way that I can get back power is to even the score somehow, and then I see all the media attention to all the whys and wherefores of the personality and the, you know, why did this happen and so on with this person who did this, then it's not too far a leap for me to start thinking, well, gosh, I could be famous too.
Yeah. You know, we try not to in the media glorify these situations. And,
right.
And I hope that media people that cover these stories never intend to do that. But we don't think about the psyche and the mental state of those that are out there watching, thinking, that could be me, you know, want their 15 minutes of fame, have a problem. You know, what we hear about this young man that took these lives at NIU, you know, people are surprised. You always hear the same story. Well, he seemed fine. But there's a lot more to it than that. There's obviously what you call the perfect storm contributing factors to why these sort of things happen. Let's go over some of those.
Okay. Well, I just talked about one of them, which is the media attention. And, of course, the media has to cover these topics. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they not, but I believe that the coverage should include a lot more about the victims and the families and the people who have been hurt by this rather than so much about the shooter. So that's number one in the perfect storm. Number two, I think, is in our families. There really is a breakdown in the nuclear family, and fewer families have healthy male role models present within the family. And by role models, I'm talking about the opportunity for these young people, primarily males so far, but to learn that when you get frustrated and when you don't win, that there is a better way to deal with it. You don't have to harden that and become bitter, and there is a way to be able to let it go to free yourself from it. So that's the second part. And the third part, I believe, is the whole violent media, violent computer games, internet games, and because what happens is these kids sit for hours and hours engaged in these games in which, in the virtual world, they blow away the person that they're trying to triumph over. And some people say, well, it's just a game, it's not a problem. But the truth is that when you sit there and not just engage your mind, not just read about it, not just see it on a movie, but you actively do something as you think in that way, there's no way it's not a rehearsal. And if those who are vulnerable to that kind of thing, it could just be the thing that inches them on further to actually taking some kind of horrible action.
You know, a tragedy, unspeakable tragedy, and our condolences to all the family that are out there, including the family of the shooter.
Yes.
But there has to be signs that we look at when we see something like this. Or is it something that it just going to happen regardless, and families really can't do anything? Because, darn it, if we can't protect our family or our children or see something that may be a potential problem and try and solve it, what do we do in a situation like this? Like, you talk about video games and media, and I agree with you completely in all of that. And the glorification of violence in movies, internet is god-awful when it comes to these sorts of things. But there must be things that we can do to try and help.
Well, there certainly are, and there are some warning signs. However, one warning sign in isolation is, you know, we would probably all have at least one or two of the warning signs at one point or another in our lives. But when you see these things coming together in a constellation, so that you have a person who is chronically angry, may be very obsessive and seem to be going over and over thoughts in their minds about how they've been wronged or how someone has not given them the what they needed or wanted, and they dwell on that, and then you may hear them making either overt or veiled threats, and those veiled threats could be things like, well, one of these days this will all be straightened out. And those are kind of alarming signs. And then especially if you see someone going and, for example, acquiring guns, as this man in northern Illinois apparently did about 6 months ago.
Right.
And they begin having a fascination with weapons or acquiring guns, then we're really going to start to get quite alarmed. And there's kind of a myth that if somebody talks about it, whether it's suicide or homicide, if they talk about it, they really won't do it. Well, that's not the truth. Most people who do commit suicide or homicide have talked about it to someone.
You know, when we talk about this, we usually talk about these sorts of cases after the fact. It's already happened. The tragedy has happened. Do we in the media, Dr. Smallwood, cover this properly? Should we be doing more as far as education, maybe trying to help those, sending out an olive branch to those that may be thinking about doing something like this, but because of something that they heard on the radio or saw on TV, they went and got some help? Or, you know, am I whistling in the wind here when I bring up that?
Well, you know, I don't think so. And what I really think is needed, whether it's in the homes or whether it's in schools or through the media, and it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, This Wasn't Supposed to Happen to Me, was to give people some emotional education, if you will, about how to deal with those frustrating emotions, not if, but when they hit, and how to make the choices that do not lead them on a destructive path, but instead lead them to be able to acknowledge reality and move on beyond that whole bitterness or isolation or avoidance or any of those negative choices into being able to take responsibility. And I think this whole thing of victimhood is a really important concept here, because these shooters seem to have felt victimized, and we all have things that victimize us. Somebody can treat us wrong, or life itself can just throw us a curve and we can feel victimized, but you don't have to become a chronic victim. And that chronic victim is one who complains more than they act. They externalize the blame. It's always somebody else to blame, and somebody else needs to change, and it's poor me. And this victimhood can grow into bitterness that then can actually become violent.
Well, you know, sadly, Dr. Smallwood, this is something that we'll probably see and hear about again, but I do appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us on the program, and, you know, all we can do is hope and pray that we won't see situations like this again, but more and more seem to be happening.
Right.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Dr. Bev Smallwood. Her book is This Wasn't Supposed to Happen to Me, 10 Make or Break Choices When Life Steals Your Dreams and Rocks Your World. It's a long title, but it's certainly a worthwhile book. And that's it. That's my show for tonight. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Don't forget to check out the webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com for archives of past shows, daily commentaries, and where you can listen live. Of course, the creme de la creme of blogs is scaredmonkeys.com. We'll see you again real soon. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.